No, there's not a Jew cabal at the center of the earth that's pulling levers, right? The global elites are, and they operate in a totally different plane that is devoid of any law and recourse, right?
If there was a Jew cabal running the world, I would not be living in Knoxville. I'm sorry, Knoxville. I'm sorry, Tennessee. But I would be in like the Hamptons or something. Like,
hot pot of the South, not your daddy's Appalachia. Hot pot of the South, progress cannot wait.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Pot of the South, a production of Change Tennessee. Pull up a chair and refill your sweet tea as we peel back the layers of Southern politics to get a better understanding of what's going on and why it matters. My name is Gabe, and joining me today, as always, is Knoxville's gayest forger of shiny math rocks, Maggie Loveday.
Hey, folks.
Today, we have a very special guest joining us. She's previously served as HBIC for Indivisible Tennessee, and now serves as the campaign director for rural organizing. Thank you for joining us, Afton.
So excited to be here, especially after those introductions.
Wow.
I think it's pretty much the most accurate way to describe your role when you're with Indivisible. I mean, you made shit happen, so.
I've heard that. And it's funny because I think I've just been so in the trenches that like I haven't been able to come out and look at it now that, you know, I've left Indivisible, but that's really kind. And I'm grateful for that description. Wow.
Definitely has not gone unnoticed for us other organizers across the state.
Wow. Am I tearing up over here? Yeah, is it?
I think so. So today we're going to discuss, speaking of organizing and organizers across Tennessee and building on the foundation that you guys did over at Indivisible, and now that you're taking into the new organization, Rural Organizing, we're actually going to discuss organizing on the big picture, and we're going to focus in on the South as we do, but also kind of talk broader, more existential questions and issues with organizing as well. But before we get into that and the nitty-gritty of it and why it's organizing is the key to the future of leftist politics here in the South, Afton, what's something that you feel just needs a really good spotlight right now?
Well, to be fair, Gabe, when you pitched this to me, I thought it was something that is, the grinding your gear segment. But I would like to spotlight that I think has gone unnoticed. So I'm a big, one of the podcasts that I absolutely love and adore is QAnon Anonymous. And so for those of you out there listening, I have relatives that are knee deep, red pilled in QAnon. My grandmother actually sent a text like right before the election that said that there were 200,000 Chinese troops outside the New Mexico border. And so since then, there's this podcast, QAnon Anonymous, that deals with the occult, anonymous, conspiratorial wavelengths in our country. And so this is a nod to them. And recently, I think that something that's not getting enough attention is Ghislaine Maxwell's trial, which is happening right now. And so for those listeners out there that don't know, Ghislaine was the right-hand woman of Jeffrey Epstein, his wrangler, his teen girl wrangler, if you will. This week, Boris Johnson's wife wrote an article saying that, and let me read you the tagline. It was floating around Twitter, which I just thought was absolutely hilarious. It's hard not to feel pity for Ghislaine Maxwell, a memoir by Rachel Johnson. And it's just like, the elites, they operate in these circles where they write these public memoirs and they think that this is like the best piece material ever, and it's super contemporary and topical as Ghislaine's lawsuit drags on in the United States. And it's like, no one cares that you ran into her in a girl's room at Oxford 20 years ago, but okay, girl, you keep going. So anyways, I just want to bring attention to the fact that Ghislaine's trial is happening now, and I'm very curious to watch the outcome.
Just the whole Epstein Maxwell fiasco as well. I mean, I think it is really telling, and I don't want to go down the conspiracy wormhole that we open up when we talk about it, but it is, human trafficking is an issue. And the fact that, a world leader is like, what she's going through must be hell, but she attached herself to the monster that was Epstein. So
Well, and also like there's as my boyfriend says, like they're so close. Like QAnoners are so close to the truth. And so I think it's fascinating to watch this unfold. It's like you're so close. You're almost there, right? And the fact that Trump, you know, it just gets a total pardon for all of this, as there's the plane logs with, you know, whatever. I don't know if Trump was ever on the plane or the island with Epstein, but yeah.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and I'm going to go tend to my potatoes and see if I have enough to make some good vodka. If not, then I'll be back. And we hope you all join us. Stay tuned. The impact of organizing is the number one concern for Jeff Bezos, our sponsor this week. He has instilled the importance of organization in his workers due to the impossible-to-attain metrics under the great eye of Amazon. This has led to an all-time high in organizing at Amazon facilities. Jeff Bezos, the only thing I want organized is the warehouse floor. Welcome back. Thank you again for joining us today. And kind of to start this conversation, we're going to kind of, you know, start big picture, you know, for you people who are completely new to the concept. You've probably been listening to us and dipping your toe in the waters by listening to us. But the question is, and people hear about it, like, what is organizing? I mean, people talk about like, oh, get involved in your community, you know, reach out to community organizers. But like, a lot of people just, I don't think, understand what organizing is at a very foundational level. It's like this like pie in the sky thing that they hear about, but I don't know how many people actually understand what it really is. So after that, I'm going to turn this over to you, as it's kind of right up in your wheelhouse. So, you know, how would you describe it?
I think this is a hilarious question, because I did not know what organizing was, even though I had been doing it my entire life, until 2016 when Trump was elected. And I think that's, for someone who is now like 5 years in, you know, has a national position with an organizing organization, I'm struck at the moment at how naive I was. And I think, you know, I think it could be a criticism of our education system that we don't incorporate community organizing or what that wasn't. But I had a graduate degree in social work, had one class in community organizing, and still didn't know what organizing was. So, and I think it's so important, because organizing, you do it all, like, even if you don't know it, you're doing it, right? When you are standing up, you know, when someone is berating a McDonald's employee, right? And you are in there and you are condemning the behavior, right? And organizing your people, you're the bystanders around you to be like, this is inappropriate, right? You're organizing in that moment. And I just want it to be, you know, yes, there are paid organizers like myself that instigate and catalyze change, right? But everyone organizes in their daily life. My mom is an organizer. She is a state certified Tennessee apiarist, which, for those listeners that don't know, she's a beekeeper and she inspects beehives. And she is an organizer. She was a Girl Scout leader. She organized Girl Scout troops. She organized Girl Scout trips. She organized beekeeping state conventions, right? And I think it's so striking to me that people don't. And even when my parents tried to describe what I do now, they are at a loss for words, right? So I want to make sure that people know that organizing, it should be the name in itself. Like, you are probably organizing. If you're organizing people in your community to take action, if you're organizing an event where people can learn something, that's organizing. But my role model in organizing is Saul Alinsky, who wrote Rules for Radicals. It was the first organizing book that I ever read. And he defined organizing as change coming from power, and power comes from organization. And so the more organized you are, the more power you have. And I think as I refine that more and more, I really think that organizing, especially the organizing that I do in terms of electoral politics, is the nexus of paradigm shifting, policy, and power, right? And so those three, I look at it as a triangle, as kind of the space that I occupy in the midst of this triangle. So yeah, that's what I think organizing is, I guess. Does that answer the question?
It does. And also think you touched on a bit that I think people don't realize, and that's kind of that informal organizing, which is doing what's right, sticking up for the little guy. People do that every day. You do, like, everybody does that every day. And I don't think people realize that that's contributing to whatever movement, you know. Organizing isn't just on a political level. I mean, what we do, the three of us and what rural organizing and Indivisible and Change, what that does. Yes, that's organizing on the political level, but there's also organizing on the social level. And, you know, it's building community involvement, whether it's just getting your neighbor involved, your drinking buddy involved, or your squash partner.
Or your family. Like, yeah. Think about all the people that are coming home. And I know that the subject line of every single, you know, major news story in the United States in 2020 was how to talk to your family about the election, right? Because there's just, and it's like you go into, especially growing up in East Tennessee, like you go into your room and you're talking to your uncle who's launched in this diatribe about supply chains and inflation, and you talk to him about consolidated corporate control, you're organizing, my girl. Like, you're organizing.
I think another way for people to realize that you're organizing in a very simple way in the South is definitely like in the church. Like, if you're in the church trying to get people together to do something for like a potluck or a Bible study, like you're organizing people by doing that, and you just don't realize it.
That's absolutely right, Maggie.
You know, I think a great example, exactly what you're talking about, Afton, and, you know, talking about family, like my brother, he started listening to this podcast. We're fairly different on the political spectrum, but he's like, there's a things where we'll be on the exact same page of like, no, like the ruling class, like, is fucked. And like, that's where we need to focus our energy, is bringing the power back to the people. And like, even if it's something just as passive as getting people to listen to something, you know, you don't have to have that intense conversation and sit down and give your lecture. You know, it's like, hey, get them to listen to something. Maybe it's a song. Maybe it's a piece of artwork. Go on that, like Squid Games, right? You know, is all the rage right now. And it's, you know, probably by the time this comes out, it's already had its 15 minutes of fame, but it's a social commentary on class structure in South Korea. Like, that's the entire concept of the show. And it's to understand how bad the microloan economy and the microloan industry has gotten in South Korea. So we are kind of talking about ways of like passive organizing and like not having, not, because, you know, no one likes something being shoved down their throat, you know, especially in the South. You know, the first thing that comes to mind are, you know, the quote unquote Bible thumpers who like, oh, you're going to hell for whatever reason they feel like when they woke up that morning. Like,
the guys that stand on the corner at campus and yell at you for going to hell because you're wearing pants and not a skirt.
So getting back in, like, in Democratic/leftist organizations have a tendency to be very pedantic and like high and mighty when they're getting in the community, or at least like at a national level. You know, the elitist, the Democratic elitist is kind of, or the leftist elitist is the phrasing that gets thrown around a lot. So, you know, I think leftist organizing has its own unique sets of challenges that they have to address in order to get their message out there. And so I'm kind of curious, you know, what are some of those that you found that exist out there, Afton? And, you know, kind of what have you seen that has worked, and maybe some things that haven't really worked?
In terms of, you know, what's working, so like you asked me to talk about Minority Opinion, challenging power structures, like caucus building as a leftist. And I think the context of Tennessee, it's an incredibly difficult landscape to organize in. And I think I'm so resilient and scrappy because I have had to organize in this state. And I think all of us can attest to that. But I think in terms of challenges and, you know, how to overcome some of those. So what you mentioned, Minority Opinion, I think that especially in a really robust Democratic state like Tennessee, where the Democratic Party, not necessarily with disaffected voters or Republicans, but among Democrats, like, they love being Democrats in this state, right? Like, they love the brand, they love being Democrats, right? And as a leftist, like, that's just not my tea. But I think it's really, really important in these races, especially as we head into midterms, that leftists form caucuses and coalitions with moderates in order to win back some of these House races and Senate races in 2022. And I think especially in Tennessee, you see this dynamic play out where incumbent politicians often, especially on the Republican side, worry about being primaried rather than a credible Dem challenger, right? And so, you know, in Tennessee, we're like, well, the real election is the Republican primary, right? Which absolutely sucks. But I think the more and more work we do and the more investment we have in capacity building and year-round organizing, that we're able to shift that to some of these general elections, especially in areas like Knoxville, Murfreesboro, Nashville, where there's incredible growth, right? And there's opportunities to take back. And once again, sorry, I see all of this through an electoral lens. And I often, as an organizer, I straddle the line between movement and electoral, right? You will meet people, maybe you've had organizers on this podcast that are strictly movement organizers, right? But I try to have one foot in both. So I'm wearing my electoral hat for this episode because we are heading into midterms and it's a critical year. But all that to say is I think especially we've seen as leftists, like the primary landscape is so important. Organizations like Justice Democrats nationally and the work that they're doing in terms of supporting primary challengers, helping them fundraise over moderate Democrats. And it's so important in these primary elections because guess what? Like your messaging will shift the platform. And we saw that in the 2020 presidential election around Medicare for All, right? You look at the exit polls from every Southern state in 2020, the Democratic primary, who was the real winner? Not Bernie Sanders, I wish. But Medicare for All. Medicare for All was majority supported in every single red state. So I think we have the issues. Like I think that the successes, we just have to be able to point to them. And then in terms of like challenges of leftist organizing, especially in a state like Tennessee, there's a lot of gatekeeping, Democratic gatekeeping. And I think it is our responsibility and duty to elbow our way to the table, but then to make room for the most disenfranchised and marginalized people so that they can accumulate power in a way that they're dictating strategy and they are like our agendas are based from what they believe. But there's always going to be consistent conflict in between the people who are in power and the people who are organizing, especially to improve the quality standard of life. And I think something that organizers don't talk enough about is the status quo. And this goes back to your initial, like the informal organizing piece, right? If you've ever questioned like, you know, why is my grandmother in her terrible nursing home? Or why do I owe thousands of dollars of student debt? I think that moment in time is so important that you are looking at the status quo and you're saying something's wrong, right? Like something is very, very wrong with this. And I think as you become a more seasoned and mature organizer, you realize that obviously power holders, their entire goal is to maintain the status quo to protect their wealth, income, and political power. So there's insurmountable challenges, but I do want to say that I think there is hope at the end of the tunnel in terms of leftist organizing nationally and as well as in the state. I think nationally, leftists are the most organized that we've been, and especially reading like the reflectives from Occupy Wall Street and the WTO organizing that happened. I'm excited to see leftists staying here, organizing here, building power here, starting organizations like Change Tennessee that can spend money and influence elections, which is a really big deal. And so I think there's a lot of hope in that.
You touched on something and I want to kind of put it on Maggie because I think she, like kind of from the front lines of that, you know, talking about the power structures and trying to elbow your way to the table. Because Maggie, you know, as an organizer, as a voice for Indigenous populations, I mean, that's like one of the number one communities that never gets talked about and like never has a spot at the table. I mean, it's a huge deal with Deb Haaland with her position now. But I'm kind of, you know, I want to get like your perspective on that. Of you have done a great job of elbowing your way to the table to bring up Native and Indigenous population issues. Kind of what's that been like, especially in the state of Tennessee, you know, where we talked about the Native populations episode, the Cherokee Nation here was one of the largest land things, and now there's no one here.
Yeah, so I think it's really interesting to have these conversations, especially with my dad. My dad is a Cherokee medicine man. And so talking about organizing with my father, he's been with the Sierra Project for a really long time. He did organizing like pretty much all the way from, you know, his 20s up until now, he's almost 70 or whatever. And so I've always been around, especially doing stuff for green energy. And my dad was very big on having his voice heard as far as like protecting the land and making sure that animals are protected, the bison come back, and food sovereignty. And so that's why specifically what I plan on doing when I go back to school is that I'm going to do food sovereignty specifically and making sure that more Native American voices are heard. And I will say it's hard. It's really disconcerting. For a long time, I felt really lost because I didn't get to hear any voices about it kind of thing. And that's where I'm super thankful for podcasting, because podcasting has brought a voice for so many Native American people to be able to say what they need to say that they haven't been able to have their voices heard over. And that's where social media also comes into a lot of positives for them. Social media has helped with organizing tenfold. It makes it so much easier than standing on a corner and just trying to hand out pamphlets like we used to back in the good old suffragette days. You know, like nowadays, your pockets are too small for pamphlets, but by God, you could make a post on Instagram. So
do your pants even have pockets?
Sometimes. It's really hard, and saying, you know, not being discouraged is the hardest part as far as being a minority and trying to get your voice out. And that's when you really have to rely on other people and organizations to continue to give you that support that you need. Specifically, like, just support to say, hey, your voice is heard, and this is something that I am really proud of you for saying, kind of thing. And so definitely look for those people in your community and in organizations that are looking to help support you in that way, because otherwise it gets really depressing really quickly. I mean, like, the whole world is like crashing down on you essentially at all times. But I am super thankful that there are some amazing people out there that are talking about what needs to be said. And Deb Holland is definitely one of my favorite people. She is doing so much specifically with missing murdered Indigenous women and finally getting that out. The issues of the children's bodies that have been found at residential schools and getting them home. And so I honestly think if that she was not in the position that she is in, there would not be anything said about it in a lot of the media.
And I think it's also important to note that the progressive organizations and activists at the national level coalesced around her nomination, and she's the only progressive out of any of Biden's appointees. And so I think it's especially her nomination and her position, like, she's worked her ass off as an Indigenous woman. She's built multiracial, multi-class coalitions, but to have like the more progressive establishment behind her and throwing weight behind her is so important. And it's, you know, what can happen when everyone gets behind someone, right? And I think for the other, especially in the Biden administration, like, no, Joe, you're not an FDR, sorry. The more progressive people in his administration, there, you know, there were progressives supporting them and throwing resources, time and money behind it. So
I think the other thing that's really important as well is the fact that she made sure that a lot of Indigenous people were voting. That's really hard. And there was a lot of people that supported her to be able to have her voice be heard. But also there's a lot of people that realized, oh, my voice does count. Like, because a lot of times, like on the reservations especially, it feels like nobody cares. I mean, I grew up on the reservation. I talked to those kids and those people, and they 100% felt like the government did not care in any way, form, or fashion. And also, they have a very much so big fuck the government mentality, which, yeah, I totally understand that. And so being able to have, I mean, the amount of organizers that she helped with to be able to get Native Americans their voting registration, because it's really hard to get registered to vote on reservations because you have to have an address in order to register to vote. A lot of reservations don't have home addresses. They literally just have like, you're the third trailer down off the left. Like, and so they did a lot to try and figure out how to get people registered to vote so that they could go vote.
I think that's a great example, especially keep talking about Deb Holland and coalition building and caucus building, where she elbowed and fought like hell to get her spot at the table, but then didn't just rest there.
No, you know, she kept going.
Exactly. Understood, like, hey, this is my background. This is what we need. Oh, hey, you're one degree off of what I'm fighting for. Let's meet in the middle, you know, let's unite our causes and get even more powerful, get even more room at the table. And like, exactly like what y'all were just saying, I mean, really got the establishment behind her with coalition building, had the progressive movement with her ability to coalition build and caucus build. that, you know, grassroots organization, that ability to see the forest through the trees, what it can do and how it can help move you forward and move us forward as a nation, as a culture, as a society.
And especially being, so she is specifically Navajo, the Navajo Nation in New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, all of those different separate little pockets, because there's not just like one reservation specifically, but there are pockets in that area. I cannot tell you how proud all of those people are to be able to say Deb Holland, like Director of the Interior. Like, they're so proud to be able to say it. She continues to just empower the people around her too. And I think there's a lot to be learned as far as how to continue to make sure your voice is heard and have the people around you that support you, because I know that woman has got to be tired at sometimes. Like, there's no way that I would be able to do what she does in 5 years that she does in like a day. So,
you know, kind of using her model, as we've talked about at a national level, you know, let's focus it down in, like kind of zero back down into Tennessee, the South. And, you know, she's done what a really good job in one of the challenges that leftist organizers face, again, particularly in Tennessee, being a Republican GQP supermajority state, recruiting and getting people on board with your policies, with your ideas. And I think she's kind of given a roadmap, same with Bernie Sanders, you know, kind of gave a roadmap of how you do it, gives us something to understand and how to do it. Because that's an incredibly difficult thing here. You know, I could walk up and down my street and I might have one other person that would identify as a Democrat on my street. But, you know, kind of like what you were talking about earlier, after, you know, there's ideas that are there, you know, Medicare for all, it was a huge hot button issue for everybody on the past election. And so, you know, I think, again, Senator Sanders, Secretary Holland gave the roadmap on how to recruit and organize for leftist ideology in minority areas.
Well, especially Cori Bush. I mean, Cori Bush did so much work. I mean, the Black Lives Matter movement, I think, really helped with that organizing kind of thing. Like, it sucks that all of those things happened, but the amount of power it put behind Black voices is what it really needed to happen. Like, it was finally, those voices were being heard in some way, form, or fashion as far as organizing goes. And Cori Bush literally pulled a blue out of Georgia. I mean, come on. I'm sure she always is like, well, I had a lot of other people help me. And I'm like, come on, girl. You had so much help, but also stop trying to push that crown off your head.
Kind of gave the disenfranchised voices of Georgia, like, look, you can do it if, you know, you show that solidarity together.
She knew 100%. All you had to do was go to the church cookouts, have a bunch of people there to talk, you know, like get conversations started, and then move to the next church cookout. And that is exactly what they did as organizers. And I think that is amazing. And that's why the issue of like the voter bills that are happening, to where you're not supposed to be able to go on Sundays and stuff like that, it is directed specifically at those organizers.
We're talking about recruiting and getting people involved. So, I mean, that kind of is like the next big question for people, you know, who maybe, you know, we kind of lifted the veil on organizing, like, oh, you know, maybe I don't have to be at the protest to be an organizer. I don't have to be holding a picket sign. I don't have to be on the front lines. You know, maybe I can just have that conversation with somebody when we're at the church cookout or whatever it is. I mean, what are some ways that, some less than passive ways or more than passive, depending on how you want to look at the lens, ways for people to get involved?
Yeah, I think especially in this state, there just seems to be an increased propensity for apathy. I have knocked on thousands of doors, have been in rural and urban communities in Tennessee and on Twitter. And I think it, you know, one is that in a state that is so, that, you know, we do have a Republican super minority or super majority, the situation feels very dire, right? And yeah. I think especially for, you know, your low-key Democrats that maybe show up, they follow national politics, that they don't feel like they need to be knocking doors year-round, right? And I think it's such a problem, especially in a state like Tennessee, Whereas compared to like Iowa, right? Like you have people knocking doors all the time because they know it's going to come. We're not an electoral, you know, battleground, right? But we have to be organizing year in and year out. I would like to say that I know there are folks that, for example, show up to Planned Parenthood events that volunteer for Planned Parenthood, which is important. Please, if you love an organization, you respect their agenda, you like the type of organizing that they do, go to their website, you know, find out what they're doing and become a volunteer. They not that they rely on your labor, but they are really trying to transform, as I said before, like the paradigm, policy, and the power dynamics in this state. But say you are, and I want to revisit the Black Lives Matter protests of 2020. You saw these little protests spring up in the most rural areas in the state, right? And these weren't paid organizers. They had, you know, they had no affiliation with any organization in the state. They were concerned citizens that said, I want to stand up for racial justice in my community. I'm going to organize an event. And 200 to 300 people showed up in really, really small areas, small communities in Tennessee. So whatever that looks like, but I don't want it to be an ephemeral, it shouldn't be ephemeral. Like you should continue organizing. You should be building a bench. Like the trajectory is very long and we need you to not bow out. Gabe said yesterday that he listened to the conversation with Drew and Nathan from Indivisible East Tennessee and Change Tennessee yesterday on Facebook Live. And the question was asked, how are you dealing with burnout? Like, how as an activist how you deal with burnout? And to be honest, it's we need people to get involved so that people like me and Gabe and Maggie don't burn out, right?
Yeah, like exactly.
You lessen the load for us that have to bear. I mean, I know for me personally, I feel like I've carried the weight of this state for a very long time, right? With my other fellow organizers. And the only way Tennessee is ever going to change is if you get involved and you buy into a vision that is more than the reality in front of you. And I think as leftists in the state, the best thing, and I said this yesterday, I think the most important support we can provide is articulating a bold progressive vision that transcends anything that the Democratic Party is offering, as well as is the lived reality of folks in front of them, right? And I talked about Medicaid expansion yesterday. Talk about medical debt, right? Talk about student debt, right? Like yeah. We are one of the most debt-ridden states in the country and no one's talking about it. And it's like, that hurts. Like people know exactly what you're talking about, right? And I just want to make sure like we are, and I think as leftists also, like we can be very intellectual and pedantic. And I also think that we've got to bring these issues to the people, get them involved. And it, you know, it's not going to come from paid organizers like myself. It's going to come from organic people who believe in a shared vision of the state and how they want to change it.
Yeah, 100%. I agree. And I think the other thing that is really a couple of things that you were talking about specifically, like my hometown, Rogersville, Tennessee, which is, I think their population is like under 3,000. I don't even remember what it is now. They had the tiniest little Black Lives Matter movement that happened. That was honestly, I couldn't watch the live videos that my friends were posting while they were there. That's how bad it was. But there was probably maybe 40 people there that were on the Black Lives Matter side. And then they had a literal like barrier in the middle of town separating the others. But I mean, it was the smallest amount of people. And there were so many folks that afterwards were like, well, that wasn't right. They shouldn't have been on the other side. They should have been with the Black Lives Matter folks. Like they were just trying to have conversations with folks. And you get to see that in the live videos. You get to see a lot of people pulling someone aside, like from the Black Lives Matter side to the other side on the barrier, to have conversations about what is going on, that they feel like they need to voice themselves in this way kind of thing. Because they didn't understand. They just didn't understand, which doesn't surprise me from Tiny Podunk Rogersville. Bless their hearts. I understand that not all of us have a million hours in the day, but literally taking a moment to sit down for an hour and figure out what an organization needs. It just something small. Like all you have to do is if you support that organization, say, hey, what can I do to help you right now? And it may be just as easy as making a couple phone calls or writing a couple letters. And maybe it's going through an email for about an hour to see what emails they have at that moment in time. Or maybe they need you to go stand just as a body at one of the city council meetings that's happening right now, so that they have someone there as a physical support to show that. And it's not like you're dedicating 1,000,000 hours. It's just like an hour of your life that you could do to support that community and that organization to make their voices heard. And that's all it takes, especially if you don't have money to help support them. If you don't have money, that's okay. You don't have to have money to support them. They just need like an hour to 2 hours of your time.
And I think that's huge. You know, both of you guys touched on it exactly. Without the support of the community around you, our shoulders are only so big, you know, to boost our own ego for a moment. Like, we can't bear the weight of the state for the entire time. But one extra person coming in and chipping in, like you were saying, Maggie, that 1 hour a month, you know, 1 hour every other month. I mean, that's also a morale boost. Makes us want to keep at it because, oh, our efforts aren't just being lost into the void. We're not just screaming into the void. People are listening. People are buying into what we're talking about. And it's like when you go to the store and like that, the person walking down the aisle and you're like, hey man, I like your shirt. It makes you feel good. It's the little things that just go and let organizers know that their efforts aren't being wasted, that they're not just spinning their tires. It lets them know that there is a future that people want and that there is a future worth fighting for.
And I think something other small that you can do if you do have a little bit of extra change or you do have some money right now, pay attention to the merchandise that those organizations are selling. Like, all it takes is like a $5 bumper sticker. Because you know what happens when you sell 100 $5 bumper stickers? You have a lot of money suddenly that you didn't have before. I'm thankful that Knoxville is a brewery town now because a lot of our breweries have fundraisers that are happening all the time. The brewery that I work at specifically, we have a beer tender that is a spotlight for the month, and a dollar for every one of their favorite beers is donated to an organization. And so that all you have to do is go out to that brewery, buy one beer, and you already have a dollar that you donated and you get a beer. And then the other thing is if you're feeling overwhelmed because there's a lot of problems going on around you, focus on one thing that you're passionate about right now. So for me, right in this moment in time, something that I would be passionate about is trans youth in Tennessee that are having issues with finding sports that they can play without having to worry about what's in their pants. So of course, what's something that I'm going to focus on? I'm going to look at sports of the area and organizations that are wanting to start sports in the area where trans youth can play without having to worry about any of that. Because there's nothing more terrifying than being a teenager, figuring out who you are, getting bullied constantly, and not being able to move and do exercise that helps your brain.
Here's some food for thought for people to chew on how to help out, how to get involved, how to take the burden off. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we've got a few people that could just use a good old bless your heart. Even though he's no longer calling the shots at Amazon, Jeff Bezos believes organization will be the ultimate downfall of society as we know it. He and his fellow Amazon overlords have fought tooth and nail to stop organizing at all levels of the company. Jeff Bezos, I won't let you organize because I can't lose power. Welcome back, everybody. Thank you for tuning in with us so far. And we're going to close this episode out. But before we do that, we have a few people that could just use a good old bless your heart.
It's Bless Your Heart with Bobby June.
Hello, hello. Oh, my, you little angels. Look at you, just so wonderful. Thank you. And bless your heart.
Bless your heart.
Afton, as our esteemed guest this week, we're going to let you start it off. Who needs a good old bless your heart?
Well, I would like to say bless their hearts to the House Democrat moderates. Now, I think we should take back the narrative of House moderates, right? These are people, these are Democrats who are obstructing Biden's Build Back Better plan, right? That encompasses all these progressive visions and ideas. And they were so salty throughout this entire process. And I just want to say, bless their hearts. They, on the eve of, hopefully there will be a House vote tonight on the Build Back Better plan, which includes climate provisions like the Civilian Climate Corps. But they held out. And a few of them, for example, like, we won't be able to do drug negotiations. Medicare won't be able to complete drug negotiations because these moderate Democrats felt like they were better than that. So I'm very angry at them. I think this massive federal program and stimulus package could have been a more progressive version if it hadn't been for these moderate deficit hawks. Dramatic eye roll. But eye roll and to the Blue Dog Democrats who believe that, you know, national deficits are a thing, which they are not. We make our own money. It doesn't matter. Modern monetary theory, I know you probably discussed it. But I'd like to say bless their hearts. Bless their hearts. They deserve, as my mom says in her podcast, karma bites. And you know what? Bless their hearts.
That's a good one. That's a good one. I like the way she says it.
What about you, Maggie? Who do you feel needs a good old bless your heart to make it through these next few days?
So my biggest bless your heart is, of course, for all of you that are so excited about celebrating Thanksgiving. Fuck you guys. Like, I understand the joy of being able to get all of your family together to eat a meal. This is something that I used to do as a community and the Native American community. We did ceremony, and we would, after ceremony, you have a feast and you would do feast and giveaway, which is very big part of that culture and that community. And that is how Thanksgiving started. And I think the thing that hurts me the most is the fact that rather than people getting the idea of the fact that saying Thanksgiving hurts a lot of people, and it hurts the land that you live on. It hurts the things that you're taking away from the Native American people every single time you say it. All you have to say is, hey, this November, it is the end of the harvest. Let's have a harvest feast. That's all you have to say. And that's exactly what it is you're having a harvest feast with your family so that you guys can be thankful that you made it through the summer, that you have the food that is on your table, and you all get to sit and say, you know, thanks or prayers for the upcoming winter, because that is the hardest time of the season. And, you know, I understand that feeling of wanting to continue to have that holiday, but just stop calling it Thanksgiving. Call it a harvest feast or an autumn feast. Like, say what it is and stop using Thanksgiving as an excuse. It doesn't have to be a holiday anymore. Like, you guys don't even really pay attention to that anyways. You pay attention to Black Friday. So bless your hearts.
After Halloween, it goes straight into Christmas now anyway, so.
It really does. And everybody looks forward to Black Friday. They don't give a shit about Thanksgiving. So fuck Thanksgiving. Get out of here.
I do appreciate, like, the Monday after when turkeys are like 39 cents a pound, though.
Ooh, that is also, that's very true. Because then I can go and get a frozen turkey and stick that in my freezer. And like 4 weeks later, I get to take a frozen turkey out. I get to cook a turkey. And then I have another month's worth of pretty much deli meat without having to pay $7 a packet of deli meat.
What about you, Gabe?
So my bless your heart goes out to the techno bro god, one Mr. Elon Musk. My personal favorite connoisseur of pocket emeralds. Mr. Musk challenged the UN to release how they could use $6.6 billion or $5.6 billion to end world hunger. And he said he would fund it if they released documentation on how they would do it in complete transparency. Well, Mr. Musk, time to put your money where your mouth is, because as of earlier this week, we're reporting on November 18th. Earlier this week, the UN released their multi-billion dollar spending plan on how they would use every dollar of that to end world hunger. But now that that document has been released and is open for the public to take a look at, Mr. Musk has been oddly silent on how he would help fund ending world hunger. So, Mr. Musk, bless your heart for finally being called out on your bullshit, but not having the gall to step up to the plate from what you said you would do, and are continuing to just hoard massive amounts of wealth on something you haven't done to acquire other than just be part of the lucky sperm club. So bless your heart, Elon Musk.
Bless your heart, Elon Musk, emerald miner.
Airplane for an emerald mine. What a deal.
What a gem.
Well, everybody, thank you so much for tuning in and joining us today. We hope you learned a lot and kind of got that fire under you to getting involved in some local organizations, to be an organizer yourself, or maybe just step up your own informal organizing. You know, every little bit goes a long way. Before we close out, Afton, do you have an internet home or any pluggables you want to send out to the metaverse?
Ooh, the metaverse. Well, I will choose humbly and wisely. No, if you are listening, please follow me on Twitter. I talk about progressive politics. I'm about to reach my 10,000th tweet. And so I have a special shout out to some villains that I'd like to thank. Do you remember the scene in Clueless when Cher's at the front, she receives the tardiness award and she thanks all the people that made it possible, including people that make Egg McMuffins. Anyways, I have a whole shout out that I've been prepping for literally a year. And so I'm super excited. So please follow me on Twitter for that debut at Afton Behn, AFTUNBEHN. And if you are interested in ruralorganizing.org, my current organizing home, we have a ton of polling and messaging and toolkits that if you are rural organizing, it is the best repository of information on the interweb. So please check it out.
Awesome. Well, we definitely will send people your way. And Maggie, what about you? Where do you live on the World Wide Web?
I currently live on Instagram and Twitter at Little Miss Knit, LilMissKnit. You guys can come and check me out. I'm going to start sharing a lot more of my beading that I've been working on recently. That has been a lot of really good medicine for me. I took like a $18 Target hat that I've been beading the rim of that I'm about to make a band for. It's really exciting.
Be sure to follow us on Twitter at pod_south. You can find me on Twitter at Graham851. Also, make sure to leave us those sweet, sweet 5-star reviews as they help others discover us and hear the siren song of Appalachian leftists. Thanks, everyone, and have a great day.
Pod, pod of the South, not your daddy's Appalachian. Pod, pod of the South, progress cannot wait.